This is Where We Meet, sharing conversations from New Mexico and beyond. I'm Chelsea Reedy, and this show is supported by the National Endowment for the Humanities. Taos Center for the Arts would like to recognize that it operates on the homelands of the Red Willow people of Taos Pueblo. We'd like to honor the importance of Native and Indigenous cultures within our community and within the land we live, learn, and exist on. On today's show, we speak to Rowana Shabala, a.k.a. Roe Shabala. Shabala is a Native American of Diné, Navajo tribe, and Shiwi, Zuni tribe. Shabala is a writer, poet, and performer. She brings the voice of her heritage into her performance as well as written work, hoping to reframe what it means to be a Native person for the masses, pointing out the appropriation of her people's culture and reclaiming an identity that has been distorted by heavily edited versions of history. Today we talk about her intentionality in bringing Native voices to spaces where they are not always heard. Shabala also reflects on her writing processes and the place of performance in her work. Here's the conversation. I wonder if you could tell us about really how you came to storytelling and poetry.
It's interesting. I always liked riddles when I was a kid. I always liked to talk about riddles, and I always would try to solve them. And so later on down the road, going kind of with my education, I noticed how riddles are actually forms of poetry. So, and I started to write riddles, and I started to know oh, this is poetry. And then the next thing you know, I'm in high school, and I'm in this this literature class, this creative writing class, and I start writing my first love poems for these crushes that I had in high school type of thing. It's interesting. So it was just more of a hobby type of that I liked to do when I was in high school, when I was a kid, and kind of started off with riddles. And then the an epiphany had happened was when I was in high school, I took a Native American literature class. And my teacher, her name was Mrs. Colony, but now she's Dr. Colony. She was teaching us Sherman Alexie, Leslie Mormon Silco, Simon Ortiz, and some of these really amazing Native American writers. And this whole dynamic of dead writers type of thing, I was just oh my God. When I asked her, I was when did they die? And she's what? I was when did these writers die? And she's they're not, they're alive. And it's interesting because then a little spark kind of went off in my head. And I'm what you're saying to me is I can be an Indigenous Diné woman who can be a writer, who can be a poet, and I can make a living off of that. I can be a writer. And she just yeah, you can. I was oh my God. And so that's when I kind of started getting more into writing and being more intentional on my little my poems I would write and journals that I would look into. And then after that, later down going into college, I got lost on campus and went to school at Northern Arizona University. And I went in originally as a computer science engineering program. I came out with a theater degree. I didn't really know what to do. I'm this little girl, little res girl, coming into this world of outside of the reservation, not knowing different type of degrees and diplomas and programs and things that you can do. So I didn't think of creative writing. I was thinking of how can I be creative? What can I do? Engineering is the way to go, and it seems that's what I'm supposed to do. And then I got lost in the theater building on a rainy day. And I'm ooh, that's cool. I can draw. Ooh, I can totally make my own costume. What are they doing with makeup? I'm I want to do all that. So I think the following week I went to my advisor and I want to take a theater class. So, and after that, I just kind of went on from there. But, and that's for kind of where my performance kind of came into play. When I was in college, I wanted to, to reinvent myself. So I put myself in spaces that you would not see Native people. Mm-hmm. So I joined a sorority. I was in a sorority. It was interesting. And through that, I I recruited more Native American girls into the sorority, into this like predominantly like non-Indigenous community.
What spurred that for you?
It was my grandpa, my maternal grandfather, in our language, we call him Che. So he was my Che. He was always like instilled in me like to have this bravery to speak up for the people, to be a good representation. Mm-hmm. And like I would see these different type of opportunities that were available, but you had to put yourself in uncomfortable positions. And so at that time I was just very like very rebellious and very like, I'm taking my land back. I want you to see me. Like I can do what you can do. And so I had to put myself in these different spaces. And being in a sorority was definitely one of those spaces.
And was it, how hard or easy was it to get like other Indigenous women like joining you in that?
It was interesting. Well, I had my sorority sister who rushed the semester before me. And she was also Navajo too. She was also Navajo. But she was also like, she was half Navajo and half white. So, and she also knew some people and already knew that type of like that community. So she brought me in and kind of introduced me from that. And that's where I kind of got that idea. I was like, I want to have more, Native people in this experience. It was interesting though that I was in Alpha Delta Pi sorority, and they the women there, they were so supportive. They were very supportive. They were very nice. They were very welcoming. I'm still like good friends with a lot of them, and they have, I don't know, I needed help too. So like with my schooling and like with tutoring. So there was a GPA requirement in order for you to stay in there. There was philanthropy that you also had to participate in. So I'm like, okay. So I would tell them like, you're in here. It's good for scholarships. You put it on a scholarship. You say like, I'm in a sorority. I had to keep my GPA up. I have to go to community service. And then you get to hang out with us and do all these like really girly things. And so that's kind of like, I guess I did kind of do like little recruiting in there. And then also be like, come on, let's put some brown into these places. And they're like, okay, let's do it. So it was, I was able to get a few like other Navajo girls in there. And then from there, two of my sorority sisters took me to downtown Flagstaff and went to a poetry slam. And I was the first time I saw performance and poetry on stage.
So this is really how, I mean, this is what led you really to slam and yeah, performance poetry. Wow. Okay. Go ahead. Yeah. So, okay. So you walk in, you see this for the first time and.
Yeah, it was crazy. And I'm like, I'll be a judge. So my first poetry slam, I was like a judge in this, like, it was their grand slam. So it was like, this was a team that they were going to be selecting to go to the national poetry slam at that time. So I was a judge. So I had to stay there throughout the whole night and to like really pay attention to the poetry, to the performance, to like everything in the, so I had to like really pay attention. It was so beautiful. I'm just like, this is what I want to do. I want to perform. I want to write. And this is like, this is awesome. So, I was still very, like, I got stage fright a couple of times. And so I started writing like slam poetry, but I didn't perform. I was writing these poems and like writing them to slam and like studying these poets on stage and how they perform and what type of words that they use. And here one day, my brother just like, we went to a slam and he signed me up, and I didn't know he signed me up. I didn't know that he put my name on the page. And then next thing I know, as I hear the host saying like, so-and-so coming up to the stage, Roe Shabala on deck. And I'm like, what? And I was like, no, my God. And like, I don't have my poem. And I swear it was fate. The person who was before me did a haiku. So I didn't have time to like freak out and run away. And my brother pulled out my poem that I was writing at the time out of his back pocket, put it in my hand, and he pushed me on stage. And I was so scared. Like, my paper was like, I was just trembling. You just hear the paper crackling, and I read through the whole thing. And then afterwards, I was just like, that was awesome. I want to do it again.
Cool. Yeah, no, I was curious how it was going to be, like, the feeling after. And then from there, were you just immediately comfortable, or did you have to go through that whole stage fright process?
It was definitely like, a process. So like, I would write these poems. And at the time, a friend of mine, his name's Logan Phillips, he was also a very, like, one of the well-known poets in the community at that time, and still is. He took me under his wing, and he was just like, okay, this is how you're going to do slam poetry. And I'm like, okay. So like, I remember he helped memorize my first poem, told me how to stand on the stage, how close to be to the mic, how to use my hands, not use my hands. And like, don't ever apologize. That was one of the things. So don't you ever, ever apologize when you're on that stage. It was supposed something that he had said. He was like, this is your time. This is your voice. You don't apologize for it. Mm-hmm. I was like, okay. So I remember that was one of his teachings. And then here I went on stage and I did my first performance, and I got like all tens, and I was so excited. I'm like, oh my God, I did that. And then they're like, okay, now you have two more poems. Like, what? Like, I don't have two more poems. That was my only one that I did. So they tried, like, we tried to go on there, and I read like two other poems, like, off of page, and I lost. But after that, like, I understood like what I needed to do. And that stage fright is still there. It's like not as intense, of course, as the first time, but I welcome it. It keeps me on my toes, and I welcome it. It humbles me. So
speaking of your poetry, I'm going to quote here, your poetry, quote, hopes to reframe what it means to be a Native person for the masses, end quote. And in your poem, Love You Some Indians, you speak to the many assumptions and tropes played out in mainstream settler culture, from mascots, dream catchers, to Thanksgiving celebrations. I wonder if we can talk about that poem a little bit. You've had it around, I think you wrote it, or the video I saw of your performance of it, I think was from 2014. So it's been a poem that you've been living with for a while. And I wonder if you could speak to maybe the beginnings of that poem coming together.
So that poem was a long time coming, definitely. And it was a journey for me to get to that point. There's a lot of, like, of course, the stereotypes and everything of Native American people and the appropriation of our culture and like misunderstandings of a whole lot of things. I wrote a poem before that called Red Bricks, and it was a 1 minute piece. And through that 1 minute piece, it just kind of talked about a lot of things that was inside Love You Some Indians. And then I was at 2013, nationals that we were going to go to. I was representing, Phoenix at the time. I believe it was Phoenix. And, 2 weeks before we headed to Boston, was it? Yeah. 2 weeks before we headed to Boston, I want to say it was Boston. My teammate shows me this picture of a man dressed in red face, mm-hmm. confronting a Native American activist, reaching his hand out to shake his hand. Mm-hmm. And I'm just like, how could you do that? Like, how can you, like, the way you're dressed, the way you're representing, not understanding that, and just total utter disrespect to approach an indigenous person and try to shake their hand and try to think like this is honoring you while you're like, and at that time, there was just so many different things that were coming out, about how people see us and how harmful it is, to all of us, not just like, and I know a lot of people are saying on how it is towards Native, children. So I just started to write and like so many things. And like, I remember I was so like angry, and on fire that I just wrote, and that poem came out, and in maybe a day I wrote that poem. And then after that, we like workshopped it and kind of went through this whole thing, and then finally was ready. And they had like a week and a half to memorize it and to get ready for that performance. So yeah.
You've been with this poem for not a decade, but close to it. What are the kind of reactions that you get from your audience or from audiences?
I honestly haven't really had a bad reaction to this poem, and I'm really thankful for that. I've had a lot of people come up to me and say thank you for saying what you had said. Mm-hmm. Thank you for standing up for us. When it went viral for the first time, I freaked out, and I was just like watching it all on social media just kind of like go crazy, and I'm like, oh my god, and I'm like, that is so cool. Then it started to go like hundreds of people like seeing it, then that was like thousands of people, and that's when I started to kind of get like a little nervous about it, just because like, okay, all these people are seeing it, and I'm not used to being in the light, so to speak.
Yeah. And also, I'm curious for that, did it make you conceive of audience in a different way? And the reason I ask that is, well, we'll get to, like, when you're writing, are you writing for somebody? Are you writing for a group? And if you are, when you think back to writing that poem, it blowing up the way it did suddenly audience mean something different to you, or not really your conception of audience?
Yeah, it definitely did. It changed. Before, it was just like me writing just to write, and whatever the whatever I was feeling at the time, whatever I felt that needed to be said, I would write it. But then after that poem came out, and then I saw like the reaction that I had came, it made me kind of look at things like in a bigger picture. So when and even when I go and I perform, like I'll ask people, is there any particular poem that you would want me to read, or is there any, like, do you have any requests? And so some people are like, I want you to do that particular poem. I'm like, okay. And I have come across maybe one or two that come to the top of my mind of people like asking questions about it and like being a little defensive about it. Mm-hmm. But I would just always come back like, I'm trying to educate you and trying to talk to you about this. Sure. This is history. This is current events type of thing. And I'm like, okay. And now I'm just like, okay, I need to like be more mindful and more kind of thinking about it. Yeah, more mindful, because there's just like, it's, definitely talking about like our indigenous like perspectives and our issues and whatnot, that will always be like the forefront, and I'd be like, I would be very passionate about that. And but at the same time, I need to be able to listen too, and listen to what people have to say and their perspectives. And if there's something that I don't agree with and I know it's factually wrong, then I'll definitely say something. I just got my master's this past year with the Institute of American Indian Arts.
How did that influence kind of how you approach your work or do your work now, or did it? Or
I went through this through majority of my MFA during the pandemic. So like there was a lot of things that happened during the pandemic. There was of course, the pandemic. There was the BLM movement. There was like the presidential elections, like all these like craziness stuff that just like kind of happened. Like now you look back and you're like, oh my God. But I couldn't write. So I couldn't write about those issues. And it was like, I wanted to write about it. I can feel it. Like I want to write, but the words weren't coming. So I wrote very personal stuff, about what I was going through, what I was feeling, about my family, about my past, about my childhood, type of thing. And I saw those like stories kind of coming out of me. And that's kind of like where my dad comes into play. My dad's the one who, has always been my storyteller. Like my dad was just, there's always an explanation. Even when we were to get if we were to get in trouble, he would definitely, he would talk to us like, this is why you don't do this. This is, then he'll tell us a story of like a traditional story, or he'll just tell me something of his past. But there's just beautiful like story that he would tell us, and it would make us, oh, okay, we won't do that again. And we understand why. And even with just like his jokes and everything, there's just like the story behind it. And that's what I started coming out on some of my poems. So whenever I write about me and about my life and everything, I hear my dad's voice in the back of my head and his cadence and how his like pattern in his words. And so I hear that. And then I hear like my uncle, and then I hear like my, my Che, and then like how they are, and how they speak and whatnot. So that's like my manuscript pretty much. It's titled Medicine Words. And it just kind of came through all of that. And just, so it was interesting, like on how that writing has shifted, where I was very like a social justice political writer in a sense. And then now I'm over here being more personable, very more like, I like there's me. Yeah.
Do you think that the reason that you kind of went to explore that realm, a little bit more personal realm, when you were in the graduate program, was that kind of because of some influences of professors or other writers that you were with, or was it just kind of a natural thing that happened?
It was more of a natural thing that happened. The mentors that I had had there, they... like the workshops that we'd kind of go through, the things that we would talk about, they would definitely help me like with my wording and like the, you should put this in there or this, like you're missing a line here, that like they would definitely push me to like kind of be more personable or put more you in there, or like you're missing something like an adjective, or like it was just like they had like definitely have to like push these like different imagery and these different type of like sounds and everything. And I'm just like, and I had to go deep in order to find these, find these lines and find these words. And I'm like, okay, let's do it.
Is there something that occurs to you that you wish you could have said, to yourself as a emerging writer, as a younger writer?
You know, if I were to talk, I would definitely talk to my younger self about a whole lot of things that I have made mistakes about. But my writing progression, I'm very proud, and cool. I don't think I would have changed it. I don't think there's anything there that I would have changed. It's just, I think that's one thing I'm very happy of how that progressed. Of course, like you can go back and be like, don't talk to that one guy. Or I would have been like, if you're going to write a love poem, oh my God, like write a really good love poem. Like don't talk about the moon and stars. It's overdone. Like do something else. And so like, I still have those love poems. Oh my God. Like I swear if any of my high school crushes knew, then yeah.
Okay. Well, speaking of poems and all that, if you're up for reading one, we'd love that.
So I did talk about like my mom and my dad, and my mom, I love her so much. She's very, I guess, straightforward. So, and that's kind of like how my Che is. It's just like very straightforward type of thing. So, and I think that's where, when I write my poems, such as like Love You Some Indians, I was just like very straightforward and very blunt and very like to the point. And then my dad kind of just like takes you on this beautiful journey of like why you don't do that. So I'll start off with a slammier type of one, I guess. If I was an Ewok, my sister would kidnap me and name me Sunshine. Well, actually, she said, if I was an Ewok, I would rescue you and name you Sunshine, build you on a tiny house in my backyard, make you salads out of sunflowers, comb your hair, tickle your belly until your feet start to look like little hairy propellers. She would cuddle me until my dreams are of thick forest, high tree houses, two moons in the sky filled with endless stars. Cuddle me until my planet is emptied from warmongers, planet thieves, planet destroyers, golden gods, troopers, rebels. She would cuddle us back to where our ancestors sang protection songs in the morning, beauty songs. She would tell me stories about her people, how strangers from a distant land came and forced them to march, how they had sticks that shot out lightning, rods that cut deep, forced them to march, had them walk across the border of their homelands, had them watch as they murdered their women and children. I would tell her stories about my people, how strangers from a distant planet forced us to fight for our lives, how they had sticks that shot out lightning, rods that burned deep, forced us to fight the war, had us watch as they murdered our women and children. She would tell me of how these strangers came on horses, how they ran her people off cliffs. I would tell her how these strangers came in the belly of metal beasts, how they ran over my people. She would tell me how they came like shooting stars. I would tell her how they came on shooting stars. She would tell me the days her people signed a treaty to go home, how they promised to learn their ways. She would sing the songs they sang as they made their way home into their sacred mountains, how they relit the fires in their homes to ward off future threats. I would tell her about the day when we watched the Death Star die, how we celebrated, how we used the helmets of our enemies as drums, how we raised the fires to ward off future threats. That was a day, she told me, they started to see more strangers on their land. That was a day I started to see more strangers on my planet. More people with lightning sticks, more people with rods that burn deep, more like shooting stars riding in with flags, more shooting stars landing in our fields. She would tell me how they told her that they had to save her and her people. I would tell her how they told me they needed to save me and my people, how they would give us freedom, how would they rescue us from the dark side. They never stopped. Will they stop? She would tell me how they would never leave, for their comfort took her language and forced them to speak theirs, how they destroyed sacred sites, took their water until there was nothing left except the litter of war, how they took to the stars, to a galaxy far, far away, and we would sit there for a moment, let our tears run on familiar trails down our faces, holding each other, as if we can put back the pieces, as if we can stop the stars.
Thank you. Is it titled?
If I was an Ewok, my sister would kidnap me and call me Sunshine. I'm a Star Wars geek, if you can kind of.
Yeah. Is there anything you want to say about it?
It was the poem I had a good conversation with my sister, and we were talking about she was going to school at the time, and she was learning, she took a history class. And we were just talking about colonization. And then I was talking to her about Star Wars, and like we were talking, and then out of nowhere, we just like had this conversation of how like the Ewoks and how they were based off of a Native American tribe. And then we kind of thought about it into this bigger picture of how like there's this war. And of course, people are looking at the dark side and the light side and the Jedis and all this stuff. But nobody ever like looks at the people who are being affected by it, like who are just hanging out, and they're just like, next thing you know, there's like these like crazy people, crazy beings on your planet, and you're like, what's going on? And so many different things. And we were talking about that, and then it started coming up of how like, how these settlers started coming, and just like, it was interesting. And I was like, you know what? It's like, that is a good correlation on how somebody would actually understand, like what a way for them to understand, like using a pop culture reference. And this is the last poem. It's called When Songs and Story Collide. And this is like my love poem, my mom and dad's love poem, I guess. When Song and Story Collide. There in the center of my poem are my mom's lines, deeply indented in flesh, canyons of my clan, Senjikine, cliff dweller people, small cracks of sagebrush and cedar trees of the windy valley, her medicine hands, gentle hands, healing hands. There to my left, next to the doorway, I hear my dad's stories, soft and soothing, low cracks of embers from a fireplace, meticulous glass beaded words. He hands me a pen, reminds me that I too am a healer, tells me, be careful with your words, for they are precious. I come from storytellers and songmakers, from prayer. I come from survival and laughter, dirt roads and windmills, cornfields and silversmiths, from a womb of songs and a love story.
Thank you to Rowana Shibala for sharing her work and reflections. Where We Meet comes from Taos Center for the Arts in Taos, New Mexico, and is supported by the National Endowment for the Humanities. Producers include Colette LaBeouf, Chelsea Reedy, Alice Morion, Ariana Cubillos-Vogler, and Joshua Aragon. Research and writing by Jacqueline Paul. Any views, findings, conclusions, or recommendations expressed in this program do not necessarily represent those of the National Endowment for the Humanities. On Where We Meet, we share conversations from New Mexico and beyond. Thanks for listening. Be well.